How many times have you had the experience in your life of where you find out after a period of time and someone says to you, I can't thank you enough. What you did was so helpful, was so meaningful. And you're scratching your head and inside you're like, I don't know what this lady is talking about. She's referring to something. I have no clue what it is. And then she goes on to explain that you once said something or you once did something that in your mind was such a small little nothing. It really didn't even make it onto your radar screen. It was in Yiddish, they call it a Kleinigkeit. It was just a small little something. You didn't have a big deal about it. But for this person, it was like, wow, it opened up so many ideas and so many whatever it was. We very often go through life where we don't realize how our actions have such a profound impact, not just on ourselves, but on our communities and on perhaps even the world at large. There are some little things. They tell a story that back in the civil time of the Civil War, you know, you have the two competing armies, a lot of well-known, we now know them as military strategists. And there was one by the name of General Ambrose Everett Burnside. Famous. Two summers ago, my family and I, we were traveling up to Maine for a few days and we went through Rhode Island and we made a stop there. We did one of those city scavenger hunts and we took a picture. There's a statue of General Burnside. And of course, it meant a lot to me after I knew this story. And I took a picture with my son and we have that picture. But what's the story with this general? Well, the general had a very different grooming style than most of us. He decided to let the whiskers on the side of his face grow. And with big, bushy sideburns. Oh, I didn't mean to say that. He was known as General Burnside. And it got actually known for the longest time that style was named after him as Burnsides. Well, we now know it as sideburns. They tell another story. About there was a very English tradition where you have all of your Earl of this and the Earl of that, and everybody's prim and proper. And they tell a story about a culinary tradition. As legend has it, this fellow, this English nobleman, he had a bit of an appetite. And he decided one day that he was going to take a slab of meat and he was going to put it between two pieces of bread. And guess where he was from? Yes, it was the Earl of Sandwich. Yes, these little things, did they know that it was going to become a thing? Did they know that it was going to have such long longevity to be referred to for the rest of time this way? No. But if it's true for trivial things like this, then it is most definitely when it comes to things that are sacred. The little things we do. Ah, if only we knew. Just the magnitude of those little things. Let's start with three people in our history. If you have your source sheets, we refer you to source number one. Source number one is the story of Joseph, of where Joseph, again, he has this falling out with his brothers, and the brothers decide they're going to kill him. And who steps up to the plate? One of his brothers, his eldest brother, Reuven. For source number one, taken from our book of Bereshit, it says, they said to one another, here comes that dreamer. Come now, let's kill him. Throw him into one of the pits and we'll say, some savage beast devoured him. We'll see what comes of his dreams. But when Reuben heard it, he tried to save him from them. And he said, no, let us not take his life. And Reuben went on to say, shed no blood. Rather cast him into the pit out in the wilderness, but don't touch him ourselves. What was the point? The Torah itself tells us what was in Reuven's mind, intending to save him from them and ultimately restore him to his father. Reuven's intentions were very good, was to save Yosef. But wait, let's read the next one. The Torah tells us that Moshe, when he was being approached by God at the burning bush, and he tried all different excuses why he's not the right guy. But finally, after God says, don't worry, I'm with you, I'll take care of it, Moshe's almost his last argument is don't choose me, choose Aaron. Aaron, he's my older brother. It's only bekavod, it's only respectful to give it to my older brother. God gets a little upset with him and says, not only will Aaron be with you, but he's going to come out. He's going to greet you when you come back to Egypt, and he's going to give you with open arms and be so truly happy that you have been chosen for this role. And in fact, the Torah tells us in the next source that God said to Aaron, go to meet Moshe in the wilderness. And what did Aaron do? He went out, met him at the mountain of God, kissed him, and he showed tremendous affection to his brother Moshe. I know I have an older brother, and thank God we get along very, very well. And I use the opportunity very often to try to chide him and to dig in a little deeper, right? But, you know, he's your older brother. You would expect him. But Aaron understood. This was a job for Moshe, and he was genuinely thrilled. But now we come to source number three, and that's the reason why I chose this topic, is because we read on Shavuot, we read the book of Ruth. Great, great story with unbelievable lessons. It's not for tonight, but the Midrash tells us we don't learn. It's not a book of laws per se. We learn some laws from it, but it's not meant to be. It's a story. But what's the punchline? What's the overarching objective? There's no laws of purity and impurity. What's the message? It's all about teaching us character development. It's all about how we behave. We'll talk about it another time. But in this particular chapter, this is already the story, and I don't know if everyone is familiar with it, but Ruth is not a Jewish woman at this point. And she marries this man from the house of Elimelech. That's his name. His mother-in-law's name is Naomi. Her mother-in-law's name is Naomi. And to make a long story short, Elimelech decides that he's going to leave Israel. He's going to travel to another place. Why? Because there's a famine. Even though he himself was financially well off, he chose to leave and to abandon his people. And the book of Ruth tells us that he suffers tragedies. Two of his sons both die. He himself dies. And all that's left is the mother-in-law Naomi and the daughter-in-law Ruth. Everybody else is pretty much gone. And the story goes that they come back to the land of Israel and they are nothing. They're a shell of what they were when they left. And they have to gather. They have no food. They have no really anything. And the story goes that Ruth has a relative, distant, but a relative by the name of Boaz. And again, I really recommend, it's only four chapters. It's worth reading. It's a beautiful, beautiful story about caring for other people. But ultimately, the story ends with Ruth converting to Judaism. She chooses to follow her mother-in-law, Naomi. Where you go, I go. Where you stay, I stay. Your beliefs are my beliefs. I accept 100% to become on board with Judaism. At this point, they come back. And as I said, Ruth has to go and to basically collect food. She has nothing at home. So in this particular verse in source number three, it tells us that at mealtime, Boaz says to Ruth, come over here and partake of the meal and dip your morsel in the vinegar. So she sat down beside the reapers. He handed her roasted grain and she ate her fill and had some left over. Stop. Is that a fancy meal? No, by no means. It's a bunch of little barley grains or wheat grains that they roasted and just, you know, enough to eat. But this is not a three-course meal. This is by no means a dairy meal or the brisket. Nothing of the sort. Very simple, basic survival. So we have three stories. One regarding Reuven, who does something to try to save Yosef. We have a story of Aaron, who comes out joyously to greet his brother Moshe. And we have a story of Boaz offering basic food sustenance to Ruth. Why? What's so significant about these three stories? Let's read a Midrashic comment on this. Look at source number four. Rabbi Yitzchak, the son of Marion, said, the scripture, meaning these verses, came to teach us that if a man is going to do a mitzvah, let it be done with his whole heart. Now, if Reuven had known that the Holy One, blessed be he, would write about him, quote, and Reuben heard and delivered him out of their hand. On his shoulders he would have brought him to his father. Reuben wouldn't have just suggested, let's throw him in the pit, and silently, secretly, his intention was to come and take Yosef out of the pit. Had he known that God was going to record this for posterity, for eternity, he would have done it in the most magnanimous way possible. He would have brought Joseph back on his shoulders, back to his father. And if Aaron had known that the Holy One, blessed be he, would, I lost the rest of this line here, but if he had known he would have come out, that he would have come out to greet Moshe, he would have come out with tambourines and dances, he would have met him. And if Boaz had known that the Holy One, blessed be he, would write about him, and they reached her parched corn, okay, corn, wheat, I don't know, whichever version you want, and he did eat and was satisfied and left thereof, he would have fed her with fattened calves. He would have given her a three-course meal. See, here's the hard part, folks. When we read all three of those stories, who did you think was the hero in the story? You thought Reuven was the hero? You thought Aaron was the hero, and you thought Boaz was the hero because they went out of their way to try to do something good. The Medrash seems to suggest that while, yes, they did it, they did not do it in the best manner. They could have done more. And had they known that it would be recorded this way, they would have put their entire whole heart, their entire fiber, every fiber of their being to do it even better. The Medrash continues, well, hold off on the rest of the Medrash, just for right now. They all truly, let's be honest here, they all truly displayed enormous strength of character. Reuven was willing to go against his brothers. Aaron, as the elder brother, probably could have felt a little bit of jealousy, a little bit of being one-upmanship from his younger brother. Boaz could have easily said, not my problem. He could have taken care of it through his workers if he wanted to give anything whatsoever. But they didn't. They went and did stuff that they didn't have to. Yet, they might have done more if they knew that it was going to be recorded in the book for all time. It's a problem that I think is indicative of human nature. Even when we do things that are good, even when we do things perhaps that are correct, and it took a little bit of effort, or even I'll even say you went above and beyond the expectation, did you do it the best way possible? You say, it's just a little thing. What's the difference? I'm doing it. No. If you're going to do something, do it right. Do it 100%. You say, but what's the difference? I'm fulfilling. Reuven's going to save Yosef. No, that's not enough. You see, had you known that it was going to be done in public, had you known that it was going to be recorded, you may have done it differently. I'm gonna raise a question on this in a moment, but bear with me. You see, details, little things, we totally underestimate their value. We really do. I'll give you another example. Let's take a different example. Tell you a story. The story is told about my namesake, my English name. Well, I'm not going to tell you. Whatever. Neil Armstrong. You know Neil Armstrong? You all know Neil Armstrong. Neil Armstrong, what's the most famous line out of his mouth? One small step for man, a giant leap for mankind. Right? You're all familiar with that. Do you know that he messed it up? He skipped a word. It was supposed to, think about the sentence. We've become so conditioned that it's such a great sentence. Oh my gosh. It makes absolutely no sense the way he said it. It does. A small step for man, but it's a giant leap for mankind. How could it be both? How could it be a small step for man and a giant leap for man? Man and mankind is the same in that sentence. Oh, he skipped one word. He skipped a word. You know what the word is? A. the sentence was supposed to be, instead of 10 words, it was supposed to be 11. A small step for a man, a giant leap for mankind. Now the sentence makes sense. For me, my personal man, it was a small step. But what it represented for mankind, that was a giant leap. That's really the way the sentence should have been, but he messed up. We are conditioned to think that only the big things matter. Think about it. One word is missing, and that word is one letter. It changes the entire meaning of the sentence. How many times have we had a class, and I point out to you, look at the grammar, the way the word is phrased, or the word or the letter is written a certain way. Yes, the little things is really what matters. We are so conditioned to think that it's only the big things. Ah, splitting of the sea, that's a big miracle. Sun rising in the morning, or me being able to reach into my pocket and actually find my glasses cleaner cloth the first time? That's not a miracle. Come on. How about, oh no, come on, Rabbi, it's only the really big things when you go ahead and you can change the world. That's big. But okay, you know, there's only two people on a Zoom class. What kind of impact can it be? Can't do that. You can't do that. We are totally undervaluing what we're calling the little things. Everything. Think about this. Perhaps the grandest event in the Torah. Creation itself. It's massive. I dare all of you to try to do it on your own. Yeah, good luck. Right? It changes everything. It's only 31 verses in the entire Torah. That's it. 31 out of the entire book. And yet, towards the end of the book of Shemot, at the end of the book of Exodus, we're told about the construction of the Mishkan, the construction of the tabernacle. There's not one chapter. There's not one entire parsha. There are four entire parshiot that talk about the construction. First, you're given the details as the commandment in unbelievable gory detail. And then you have two parshiot that actually talk about how they did it. Come on, Rabbi. It's details. It's minutiae. Come on. It's got to be. The big things, creation, revelation at Sinai. How many verses is the Ten Commandments? It's a handful. Yeah, because we have it backwards, folks. It perhaps is the daily, dull, mundane, quote, little things that really have the largest significance. It's not the big things. Yeah, there are some big things that are obviously significant. But we fall into the trap of thinking that it's only the big things. And that's a big mistake. To go ahead and only have the big things is a mistake. Let me explain further. Let's talk about this Mishkan for a moment, the tabernacle. Look at source, where are we at here? Look at source number, well, not yet. Hold on to that. Let's talk about this Mishkan, this tabernacle. What can you tell me about it? I'm going to take you off of mute. I hate lecturing. Let me hear from you people first. Hold on. I can't. Okay. Feel free to talk up here. In your mind, what is the objective of why God asked us to build the tabernacle? What's it supposed to be? You're all off of mute. I know it.
Should we dwell on it?
Go ahead.
The dwelling place.
A dwelling place. What does that mean? Isn't God everywhere? That's a rhetorical question.
I'm a comb.
It's a symbol of a place where we can gather that we feel that God is with us, even
Great.
Though God
Excellent.
Is everywhere.
Excellent. Fabulous. was this the first time God asked us to, or God allowed us, or God was part of creating such an environment? Is this the first time?
No. God created everything.
Why, Deb? I can't hear you.
God created everything.
That's true. That's true. But how about a specific location for using David's word of a dwelling place? Where else did God dwell?
Eden.
Oh, the Garden of Eden. How about one other place where God was so revealed, his presence was imminently felt?
Sinai.
Or Sinai.
There you go.
Or Sinai.
So other than going through in really in tremendous detail, and I once did a two-part series on showing almost verse by verse the parallels between the Garden of Eden, the Sinai experience, and the building of the tabernacle. They're really one long chain. They really are very much connected. In simple terms, the Garden of Eden was God's creation for that dwelling point. Obviously, God dwells everywhere. God doesn't dwell. God is everywhere. But having, as Marcia said, a place where we can relate to it, where we can use it as a form of connecting, well, God created that and put Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. It doesn't get better than that. In fact, we always talk about that when the end of this whole story takes place, when God will bring us Mashiach and will we return, we're going to go back to a Garden of Eden existence. So that must have been the starting point. I'll just give you one quick example. Look at sources number 5 and 6. He drove the man out. This is talking about after Adam and Eve did mess up. What happens? God says, that's it. Everybody out of the pool. Banished. Goodbye. So where does he go? So the Torah says God drove man out and stationed east of the Garden of Eden, the cherubim and the fiery ever-turning sword to guard the way to the tree of life. God throws them out and puts up guards. That's what it says. I'm just using the words. He puts up sentries, guard posts, so that man can no longer go back into the Garden of Eden. What are those called? They're called cherubim. Interesting. There's only one other place in the entire text of the Torah which cherubim are referenced. Yeah?
Mishkan.
Number 6. Where in the creation of the tabernacle, the construction, it says, God said, make 2 cherubim of gold. Make them of hammered work at the 2 ends of the cover of the ark. Yeah. It's the only 2 places where that context is. I'm giving you a taste. There's literally tens of parallels between the Garden of Eden and the building of the tabernacle. David, you had a question?
No, I was going to make a comment, and I don't know if it's about Shekhinah.
Go ahead.
And the relationship between that and the dwelling place for Hashem between the Shekhinah, between the cherubim.
There's a lot that's said, but my goal is really just to show you a parallel. If you want to think of it in these terms, that the temple or the tabernacle, which you write, is the paradigm for that encounter with God, where it was the Garden of Eden. Once we were banished and were not allowed back in, God gave us a microcosm, a small version of it, called the tabernacle or the temple. It's Gan Eden. It's the Garden of Eden in mini form. Even the conditions for the Garden of Eden. You have to obey and have obedience to the commandment. God said to Adam and Eve, you may eat freely of all the trees, but don't eat from that tree. Remember that one? And what happens if you do? If you disobey, you disrupt the natural order. You now are going to have to, thorns and thistles are going to be your, right? You're going to work the field. And now you're going to just produce thorns and thistles. You defy, you get banished. Isn't that exactly the same story what happens in the temple? We're commanded to obey the laws in the land of Israel. We followed it. Great. We had the temple for 400 plus years. We started to disobey. We started to defy. Boom. Banishment. It follows the same pattern. The Garden of Eden. The truth is it's all of Israel, but specifically when it comes to the temple, the iconography, there's so many symbols with the vessels in the tabernacle and in the temple that match exactly what was in the Garden of Eden. The cherubim is only one of those examples. But Rabbi, does it really matter if I make this vessel look like this? Does it really matter that the menorah in the tabernacle had not just the number of branches for the lamps, but it had to have a certain design, certain number, height it had to be, and it had to have a flower design, and it had to, who cares? Let the craftsman decide. Whatever it's going to be, it's going to be. No, and the showbread, no, that's got to be exactly 12 loaves. Oh, because of 12 tribes, but it has to be certain height, has to be made. Certain ones are copper, certain ones are silver, certain ones are gold. Who cares? Who cares? Aye, who cares? It all makes a big difference. Look at number 7. 7 really bangs it home. King David in the verse in Psalms says, Hashem, ohavti ma'on beitecha u'makom mishkan kivodecha. God, I love your habitat, your home, and the place where your glory dwells. Why did he phrase it this way? Says the Midrash, because the tabernacle corresponds to the creation of the world itself. I did you a favor. I only copied day 1. It was 7 days of creation. We would have approximately 4 pages of sources just from this. You're welcome. Here's the example. How is this so? Concerning the first day, what does it say? In the beginning, God created heaven and earth. And where else? What else do you find? God stretched out the heavens like a curtain. Curtain? Hey, that sounds familiar. Concerning the tabernacle, it's written, you shall make curtains of goat's hair. And this and that. And it goes through all 7 days of creation and shows the parallels of the specific items in the tabernacle. But Rabbi, who cares? Yeah, this is really the punchline. Is that what you think is a small little detail down here really corresponds to something that is of cosmic importance? Every little thing down here. What's the difference? It matches with this vessel or that vessel, and it's so big and it has so many handles, and who cares? But what if I told you that if you design it this way, it's going to have a connection to something in terms of the cosmic view of the world? Think of a building. Think of a building that's 10 stories high. And you have one tiny detail on the architectural blueprint. That's a little different. How's that going to play out? It's going to look a little funny. It might even look like the Leaning Tower of Pisa, right? Purposely. You go ahead and you start tinkering with what you think is a tiny little detail. You're tinkering with a cosmic situation. Don't underestimate how little, or really how big, it really is. We generally, as I said before, we generally try to think of these massive revelation moments as grand events, splitting the sea, the thunder of Sinai that we experience on the holiday of Shavuot. But yet the Torah only tells us a few verses about them. The construction of the tabernacle with details about how big, how many cubits, how many this, how many that, and not once, not twice, but 4 parshiot. Yeah. The revelation of God can also be borne out with the attention to the most small of details. I've been asked many times, Rabbi, how come the Torah is so obsessed with the details and minutiae of performing a mitzvah? Does it really matter if I have 3 hadassim and 2 aravot in my lulav and etrog? Does it really matter that it's going to be like this? Or that? And the sukkah has to be made of these kinds of walls and that kind of roof. I get it. It's just get the flavor of it. That's what it's all about. You know, put your heart into it and walk away. What's the difference? You know, many of you might be aware there are laws about how you get dressed in the morning. Yeah, it talks about the order of things. It talks about, let's say, for example, putting on your shoes. For old school people like me who still use laces, not the slip-on, right? Or even slip-on, doesn't matter. Which one should you put on first, right or left?
The right.
Right.
Do the right one first. Rabbi, who freaking cares? What difference does it make? Oh, and if you have laces, so you put the right one on first, but don't tie it. Put the left one on, then tie the left, and then tie the right.
Yes.
Yeah, I know that's correct. Thank you. But who cares? Seriously. And I'm supposed to wash my hands two to the right and then two to the left, not the other way. Well, if you're a lefty, do you do Shema with your left hand or your right? Do you know, I have a little pamphlet. I have it here somewhere.
Yes, whether it's dominant hand or it's right hand specific.
Here. This is a little pamphlet. It's only 20 pages, and it probably includes the introduction. 20 pages, not a lot of words, but a lot of footnotes. This is the whole, you know what the pamphlet is? The laws for a lefty as to what might be different regarding certain, okay. Rabbi, I love you dearly, but you're driving me crazy. Who cares? The minutiae, it's just, I got the general gist wrong. The general gist doesn't cut it, because the devil is in the details. That's really where it's at. People become frustrated with what seems to be an unending list and concern with what they call minutiae. But why is it any different than what became so popular just a few decades ago, when people woke up and realized that our world, from an ecological standpoint, is in the toilet and needs something to be done? How do you change the world? You know what? They came up with such a brilliant slogan. Think globally, act locally. Brilliant slogan. It really gets to the core of how do you make a difference in the world? It's not only the massive things that can change everything overnight. That's one way to do it, and it usually doesn't work. But you know how you really can affect change? Do a small thing here, in your community, in your home. I laugh, you know, here in Baltimore City. So they instituted it. Originally, it was mandated that you had to separate your garbage with recyclables and not. Soon thereafter, they broke it up. It's not really mandatory. It's recommended, right? I shouldn't say that. I didn't take a statistical analysis, but there are plenty of people who they throw out everything all at the same time. Still doesn't matter to them. It's a joke. But if you understand what's at stake, then yeah. Can I, Tzvi Tachman, go ahead and change the world because I switched and I put my milk container now in the recycling instead of in that goes into the landfill? Is that really going to change the world? The answer is my one milk carton is not going to change the world. But my one plus your one, yeah, that's going to change the world.
They're doing the same thing with the mask. It's mandated.
To be this way. It has to be. You have to think in those terms. The little things is what's going to make the difference. And if it's true in the physical sense, then it is darn for sure works in the spiritual sense. My little tiny mitzvah that maybe no one else even knows about. You say, what difference does it make? It does. It has cosmic ramifications. This is how we have to view it. Everything we do fits into this concept. Helen Keller once said, great quote. She said, I long to accomplish a great and noble task, but it is my chief duty to accomplish small tasks as if they were great and noble. That's how you have to look at it. I don't know if I'm ever going to go down in history as the greatest who impacted millions of people around the world. I have no idea. But I do know this much, that I can go ahead and I can get 15 people who care about their Judaism, 15 people who want to learn how to be better people, how to be better as part of a Jew, whatever, I can make a difference. Is it going to make it to God's top 10? I don't know. And truthfully, I don't care. That's not the point. The point is you have to understand this little thing, you know, in the scheme of things, for 45 minutes, there's plenty of other things going on around the world that also are important. But for 45 minutes, I have 15 people at least entertained with a smile every now and then. Learn something, hopefully. Put it into practice, even better. But it's a little thing that really has tremendous import. And that's how we have to look at all of this. When you read the story of Ruth, and you read the story of Reuven, and you read the story of Aaron, yes, they did a good thing. But what was the significance? Oh my gosh, yeah, they could have done it better because they didn't think that it was that important. They did something important, but was it that important? Why do I put on a tie to teach? Really, does it make a difference? Especially, I'm not even in front of you. I could have tilted the screen. You would have no idea whether I'm wearing a tie. You don't even know if I'm wearing shorts right now. I'm not. Don't get nervous.
Yeah. But I know this every night that you're right? wearing a tie, Rabbi T.
Yeah. Liz, you know, do I wear a tie to the office?
No. Most of the time.
A rare occasion.
Only when I'm teaching. That's the only time. Unless, you know, or a funeral, if you want to put the two in the same boat. Thanks. Right? It's a little thing, right? But it makes a statement. We are learning Torah. And I am a teacher who of Torah, it deserves to be a certain way. Is this going to change everything? No. But it's a little thing that has great importance. There's a certain way you do it. That's my view on it. We have to look at it. If you knew that it was going to be recorded for posterity, Randy, wouldn't you do things a little bit differently? You would do it a little bit better? Yeah we all would. So if Reuven knew, if Aaron knew, and if Boaz knew that it was going to be recorded, they would have done it better. But you say to me, okay, maybe back then. But how about now? Let's go back to that long medrash. That's the top, for me, it's the top of page 2. It's the end of source 4. Towards the end of source 4, I stopped. Rabbi Cohen and Rabbi Joshua of Sichnin, in the name of Rabbi Levi, said, everyone have it? It's about 6 lines from the end of source 4.
I learned you were going back to this, so I didn't ask about it.
Previously, when a man performed a mitzvah, a prophet wrote about it. But now, when a man performs a mitzvah, who writes about it? You see, the way it was presented is that if they'd known it was written in the book, they would. So who's writing our stuff down? Continues the Midrash, Elijah the prophet writes it. And the Mashiach and God seal it with their hands. You think anything escapes God's view? Nothing. The book. What book is he talking about? It's recorded in the book. Maybe it's even talking about the book, the Torah. Remember, Moshe said, if you're not going to forgive the people for the sin of the golden calf, erase me from your book. Erase me. I don't want to be, I want no recordings of it. Maybe that's the book everything's recorded in. There's nothing that escapes God's view. In the privacy of our home, out in public, with friends, all alone, it doesn't matter. What we do is noticed. You say, ask yourself this question. How would it appear if it were written in a book? Somebody said, you know how we should live our life? Write your own epitaph. What do you want it to say? Write it now. Don't let someone else choose it. Write it now and then live up to it. That's really what we should be doing. Ask yourself, how would it appear in the book? Should I have this conversation? Should I not? Should I express it a certain way? Should I smile at the person I'm not so thrilled with right now? What about giving someone a frown? A stare, a glare, a glance, a motion, a gesture. Ask yourself all these questions. They all have meaning. Depends on how we do it. But let me end with one other thing, because I'm sure some of you might be asking the question. It almost makes it sound that these three people of Reuven and Aaron and Boaz, that had they known that the camera was on them, they would have really played it up. Ah, they didn't know. Oh, but, you know, if I knew that this was being recorded, I would make sure I'm wearing my power tie, my collars would be straight, you know. But thankfully, it's only going to be audio, so we're good. But it almost makes it sound like that. Had they known that that, it makes them sound a little wimpy. But I want to suggest, again, not my thought, but from what I've read, that I think if we look at it a little differently, had they known that their action had significant and was so significant in God's eyes that he, God, would have saved it and recorded it for posterity, they would have rethought it. Not because they knew that the cameras were on, but they would have taken note of this class. They would have taken note of this lesson that says, don't underestimate. If you're going to do it as if you knew clearly that God was watching and God was going to record it. If you went through life with that perspective, you would have done it differently. You would have done it even better. Not because the cameras were on you, because it gives an indication of just how important those small things were. We have to do the right thing, but we also have to do them with our heart. We have to do it full force. Don't tell, well, what will be with the little thing I'm doing now? No, everything we do is important and it has tremendous, tremendous import. Let me finish with this. Look at source number 8. When God did banish Adam and Eve out of the Garden of Eden, where did they go? The Midrash tells us, so he drove out the man, that he should, the H should be capitalized, sorry. Driving out, what does that mean? That he, Adam, went forth outside the Garden of Eden, and he went to Mount Moriah. What's built on Mount Moriah? The temple. There's your connection once again. Yeah, the little details of building a temple, of building a tower. It's to be so many feet this way and so many feet and have this thing and that thing and stop with all the details. No, never stop with the details. Why? Because Adam understood that he just got kicked out of the Garden of Eden where that was cosmic. So he went to the next best thing here on earth. That which corresponded to the Garden of Eden. The tabernacle / the temple. I'll finish with this. Some of you may have heard of a fellow by the name of Bruce Barton. Anyone know who that is? I assume was at this point. Bruce Barton. He was the famous, he did a bunch of things. He actually was a congressman. I don't remember where. But he was more famous as the ad man. He was a great guru with advertising. He was the originator of Betty Crocker. Yeah, Betty Crocker. And he once said the following. He said, sometimes when I consider what tremendous consequences come from little things, I am tempted to think there are no little things. That is the lesson I want you to walk away with tonight. When you read the book of Ruth, and this one sentence, which most of us would just glance right over, pause, and say, yeah, Boaz did a great thing. He went out on a limb and was trying to help somebody who needed help. But if he had thought about it and not just said, I'm just going to do it to be Yotze, to just fulfill my quote-unquote obligation. But if he knew that it was so significant, such that it would be recorded for all time, he would have also come to this conclusion that what he's doing is not a little thing, but a major thing. And every single mitzvah we do should be viewed through that prism, through that lens. There are no little things. The magnitude of our small deeds is massive. Questions?
Isn't it better to do a mitzvah just to do it without thinking you're going to get any accolades for it?
Absolutely. I'm not suggesting that you're doing it for accolades, but don't underestimate that it's, quote, a little thing. Do it as if you knew this was going to become, not because you want it publicized, but imagine if you knew that it would be publicized. Wouldn't you do it a certain way? You're not doing it for the accolade. That's not the motivation. But I'm looking at it from the other side. Don't underestimate and say, well, it's just a little thing. Nobody will know about it. You're right. It may be no one will ever know about it, but then it's become little in your eyes, and it should never be. It should remain a big thing in your eyes as if it were to be publicized. Not that's why I'm doing it, but understand how important what it is I'm doing. Every mitzvah I do. And the truth is, you can take it further. It's not only the active things we do, but let's say I'm challenged and I hold myself back from doing something that I really wish I could do or want to do, but I know is not the right thing. And I hold myself back. How are you going to get a record of that? That I didn't do something? But if you understood how courageous that is for a person who's challenged, remember we spoke about free will. We're each one of us at a certain point in our growth, we're all challenged. If I'm able to overcome at that point, for me, it's going tonight and not telling Lashon Hara about this class. Oh my gosh, there's so much to say, right? But I'm going to hold myself back, right? Is that going to ever be? My motivation is, oh, I can't wait to tell everybody what a great righteous man. Again, I can't wait to write my autobiography. Oh, I am just so dosh darn good. That's not why. But don't underestimate that what you do, the little thing, is really big. Sharon.
You kind of answered my question off my notes, but when sometimes if people know that they're being watched or recorded or when they're doing something, they usually do it bigger or with more meaning or more helpful because it's almost their way of showing off, right? Opposed to nobody's watching. It's like, okay, fine, it's no big deal. But if somebody's watching, it's almost like they're showing off because they want to impress somebody.
Correct. But that's my point. Don't do it to impress, to show off, but say to yourself, as if it were to be publicized, as if it were to be recorded, how would I have done it? Then that's how I should do it even when it's not. My wife and I mean, she's taught me a lot in my years, you know. It's amazing how much she's grown and all the, no, how much I've grown.
You still can't cook.
The difference between how I originally, when we first got married and we worked on, we give out on Purim, we give out various mishloach manot baskets and stuff. So she has taught me over these years that part of it has to be the presentation. And it even has to be the way you, whatever you call it, you take the back of the scissor and you do the ribber and you curl it. I looked at her and I'm said, I'm a guy. I have no idea what you're talking about. It's a piece of cake, you know? I think I once, why are you making it so hard for the guy to get to the cake? And of course, she is correct. Right? If this is how people are going to view it, then you do it right. Show it the right way. Presentation is part of it. Not because she wants to impress anybody, because if you're going to do it right.
So you've learned to curl ribbon.
Yes, I have.
but still can't cook.
Nah, that's not my thing. Randy.
I'm a little confused or need a point of clarification. Okay, they did the little things. They offered morsels or whatever. Doesn't that make a difference in the end?
You're saying
that they could have done more?
Repeat the question. I missed it.
You're saying like Boaz offered, you know, morsels and Aaron was there and
right,
you know, and they did the little things, but didn't that unto itself make a difference?
It absolutely did. But can you say that they did it in the best way possible? The answer is no. Why not? Why didn't they do it the best way? It's because they didn't take a moment to think, maybe this is not a little thing. Maybe this really is something bigger and I should treat it accordingly.
I'm confused, you know, because it made a difference. It made a difference to the recipient. But you're saying they should have done more?
Yeah. Why? If Boaz knew that in God's eyes, he was watching how he was going to do what he just did, and he really thought about it and said, wow, this is something that God is paying close attention to how I'm going to treat Ruth. Should I just give her parched grain? Or should I give her something better than that? He didn't take the moment before doing what he did was good. Not taking anything away. But had he thought for a moment that God was watching him and recording for us to learn about how to do something right, he would have done it better.
So you're saying that we should do the same thing. Like if we're going to do a little thing, like for years after a bar bat mitzvah, I would walk up to the child and hand a lollipop. Just, it's a little thing. I should have done it more, or I should have.
Well, let me ask you. If you knew that they were writing a documentary on how to treat bar bat mitzvah people, would you do that's the exact same thing?
Yeah.
You would? You would just give a dum-dum?
That's exactly right. No, seriously. I knew what the intent, what my intent
was. Is great. I'm not denying the intent. Okay. Would you have done it with the lollipop?
And I knew over the years how much it was appreciated.
You definitely are not getting my point.
I know.
We're in agreement on this. It's not that the little thing doesn't matter. It absolutely does. But could you have done it better? And would you have done it if you knew that we were all watching and now setting the example? If you wanted to leave a last will and testament to how to treat bar and bat mitzvah kids, would you leave specific instructions to give a dum-dum?
Yes.
Okay, then you did it the best possible way.
And they're still doing it today.
Then you've done it in the best possible way. I think most of us would say, well, maybe dum-dum is not the right thing. Maybe I can do something a little better. You know, maybe I can go ahead and give something. I don't know, whatever it is. But that's the question. The question is, can I have done this in the best possible way, knowing that this was how it's going to be viewed forever? If the answer is I've done it all that way, then you've done great. But the Medrash is clearly pointing out that in all three of these stories, they didn't do it the absolute best way. They could have done it better. Robin.
I just wanted to make a comment to take that further. I think connecting it, hopefully, since you're not always sure how your little things may impact other people, then you need to lead your life or live your life that everything is a big thing and that you have to be positive and do your best all the time. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct. You should always assume that this is the most important thing that is going to be viewed forever, and I'm going to do it 100% to my ability.
Right, because you don't know how it's going to affect the other person, so you do or community or whatever. So everything should be positive. Everything should be done to your best.
And don't assume that it's, quote, just a little thing.
Right, that's what I'm saying. Everything should be.
There's no such thing as just a little thing. And John, just so you know, there's no 13 principles tonight, so don't worry about it.
I just want to make sure I got it. Okay.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Does that clear it up a little better, Randy? It's going to be recorded for posterity, so say it nicely.
He's going to think about it.
Rabbi.
John.
I have a similar question that's like Randy's. Let's say Reuben should have done more. What happens if you said, you know what, I'm going to save Joseph's life and take him back home? That really would have changed the story, wouldn't it?
Correct. So?
Well, then the Torah would be different.
Well, no, you can't do that. You can't play 20/20 hindsight Monday morning quarterback. Yeah, of course. What if Adam and Eve didn't eat from that tree? We wouldn't be on a Zoom call right now. Of course. But again, let me summarize like this. The point of this lesson is that a person's perspective on how to do something in life, and specifically on how to fulfill the Torah's obligations, should be to do it with the perspective as if this was going to be recorded for all time and setting the gold standard. That's the perspective we should have when we do anything. And don't delude ourselves in saying it's not that big of a deal. It's only this. Wrong. The perspective is it's a massive deal. And I'm going to do it absolutely to the best of my ability. and not just mail it in and not just say, oh, it's just a little thing. That's the message, the perspective about doing anything. For example, right? It's a silly example. Some people are very particular, myself included, that when I make Kiddush Friday night for Shabbat, I purposely use a nice, beautiful silver cup. Could I theoretically fulfill the halachic requirement of doing it with a hard plastic cup? The answer is yes, I can. But is that how I want to do it? If I'm going to take the time and sanctify and say to my family and to myself, this is Shabbos, and I'm sanctifying it with a cup of wine or grape juice, and I'm going to sanctify Shabbos this way, yeah, then I want to do it with a beautiful silver Kiddush cup. That's a perspective. If I had done it with a plastic cup, didn't I do what I was supposed to? Yeah. But could I have done it better?
Yeah, yes. Well, actually, you know what? In hindsight, what the practice used to be throwing a candy.
I was wondering, I didn't realize till halfway through that sentence that we were back to the Bar and Bat Mitzvahs. I thought we were talking about, instead of Kiddush, we used to throw candy.
Oh, yeah.
Like, okay, I don't know where that tradition started. Not in my book.
As David would say, you have to speak Randy.
Yeah. But that's really the perspective. If we go into everything in life with the perspective as if this was now going to be held up as the gold standard, how would I do it? Then that's the way you should do it. That's really the punchline. It took me an hour to say it, but that's, I think, what I'm trying to say. All right, we good?
One quick thing.
Yeah. Sharon.
Okay, so this is kind of like backing up a little bit, but when you were talking about the story of Ruth, Naomi actually had two daughter-in-laws, and one, it's Arpa. Okay, so Naomi told her that she told both of them not to follow her because they would have a better life if they didn't, and Arpa chose not to follow her. Is there anything being said about like her abandonment or abandoning her mother-in-law, or was just written off?
No, it's more than written off. She ends up returning back to her old ways, and she ultimately mothers a child, the descendant that ultimately turns against the Jewish people. She really, I mean, she does a 180. She had been involved. She had stayed, you know, and she initially was just as sincere as Ruth was. But when Naomi had some pushback and wanted to make sure that she really would go through with it 100%, she said, you know what? It's not for me. It's not my thing. And she turned around and she just didn't leave. She went the other direction. As far as Ruth went this way, Arpa went that way.
But that's not in the book of Ruth, that as far as how far she went. It's just that she left.
What of what significance is that to us? We know that Ruth is the one who had the courageous ability to turn up her life upside down to come closer to God.
Right.
That's the lesson that we're told. But why do we read it on Shavuot, anybody? What's the connection to the holiday of Shavuot?
The harvest?
Accepting Judaism, she's accepting from the.
What's it got to because of the Torah?
Accepting the Torah.
That's good.
Trying.
Even more astounding. Who does Ruth become the mother of? Who's a descendant of Ruth?
King David.
King David.
Yep.
King David. As I said to you, and I'll end with this, Garden of Eden is Adam. Sinai experience, the building of the tabernacle, is Moses. Mashiach, the end result in all of this, is from the line of King David. In fact, that's why Adam is named such. It's an acronym for the three players that take it from the beginning of time to the end of time that brings the mission to fruition. It stands for, the Aleph stands for Adam. The Dalet stands for David. And the Mem stands for Moshe or Mashiach, whichever way you want to go with it.
Is Adam, that why we, go ahead. Sorry.
So therefore, King David, right? This is the story of David bringing it all to fruition. His birthday, by the way, is on Shavuos.
Right. He also died on Shavuos.
It's the same day.
Is that why we read Ruth?
That's one of the reasons why, yes. Correct. All right. I've held you hostage long enough.
Okay.
Have a great night, everyone. Have a happy Shavuos. Hope you enjoy a little bit, learn a little bit. Certainly eat a lot.
Cheesecake.
Liz, you can even have dairy.
Maybe I'll drive to Baltimore and have some milk and honey mac and cheese.
That sounds good. That
yeah,
sounds
it's, good. Probably, it's probably closed.
Probably.
Anyway, yeah.
Thank you, Rabbi T.
All right,
thank
my pleasure. Have a great night.
Thank you, Rabbi T. Happy Shabbat.
Bye, everybody.
Bye. Bye.